Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads, now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, September 21st, 2006, and I want to start tonight's show off by talking about what I call Big City Hicks. Now, we all think of the term hick when we think of a guy from the outback mountains and someone who, you know, has physical deformities because they've been raised in poverty and can't formulate a good sentence because they're uneducated. But I want to talk about big city hicks from the United States. These are guys that, and women, who think that they are really special and really have never been on the other side of the planet. They've never lived in a third world country. They don't know what the people in the third world countries think, how they think, or why they think the way they think. I call these people big city hicks. And there's a lot of them. A whole boatload of them in this country we call the United States. I was on a couple shows recently this past week, and I made a statement. I said that Americans have a defugality, a problem. And this is a problem that has existed for a very long time. It's an ongoing issue. Americans simply cannot see themselves through the eyes of other people. They cannot view themselves. They can't imagine people in other countries, what their viewpoints are or how they view America. Now, I've lived in third world countries. I've lived amongst the poorest people of the world. I've lived amongst the richest people of the world. And it's given me a very good insight into when I come back to the United States and I see people driving around in their cars in rush hour traffic, going to work in the morning, existing on their credit cards, on their credit for their houses, etc., and not understanding that there's a serious problem in this world. Let's take, for example, that the average American uses 16 times the resources of the average person in the world. And so let's take a look at this. 300 million Americans using 16 times the average per capita resource usage. That equals 4.8 billion people in terms of resource usage living in the United States. Now, if you take Russia, Europe, and the other, what we call the developed world, and add up their resource usage, now add in China, nearly 2 billion people, with an ever-growing demand for resources. Resources, for example, with wood, China this year outstripped the USA in terms of wood purchasing from around the world. By the year 2009, the world wood resource will be simply depleted between the United States and China rushing to use it up. Now, let's go back to the big city hicks. When we talk about support for, say, government policies in the United States, and other countries this past week, 118 countries meeting in Cuba to discuss the U.S. problem. The U.S. problem being the war on terror, etc. Now, remember that this is not simply just a Bush-contrived situation. This includes the Clintons, who are now sitting in the background, and which, of course, through the 90s did include Clintons. A little bit of controversy going on as now the documentary that tried to blame a bit of Osama bin Laden on the Clintons. But I think that's rather comical that the big boys are duking it out as to who really owns the problems of this country. But if you look back throughout history, the same group has controlled the White House, and Congress has been, as one of the congressmen put it so aptly, they are simply window dressing. So we don't have a balance of power. We don't have democracy. Why are we trying to peddle it in other countries? And why are the big city hicks of the United States pretending that they somehow have the right or the ability to deal with the problems of third world countries? Now, as the 118 nations met in Cuba this past week, you have to understand their vantage point. And if you can't, then here's a suggestion. Not a suggestion, it's a requirement. Before you make judgment on these countries, you take a one-way ticket, like I've done, and go to a third world country and live there amongst the poor people, not for a day, not for a month, not for a year, but for many years. And without resources other than the resources you would gain in that country by living amongst those people. Not by being an executive in an American corporation living high off the hog in that third world country. And when you come back to this country and see the United States, the pathetic situation with what I call big city hicks, possibly at that point, and only at that point, will you cross the barrier where you will start to see life as it really is in the rest of the world. Now, I want to give another example of big city hicks. Let's take the person that goes to Mexico. I always love people go, oh, yeah, I've been to Mexico. Let's see, maybe Cancun, Ixtapa, Mazatlan. In the, the bus ride or the taxi ride from the airport to the 3 to 5 star hotel, staying there for numerous days, playing on the beach with the servants of the local community serving you as your every possible need, and then you get on the taxi, go out to the airport, and fly home. That isn't going to Mexico, believe me. Mexico is a very different country than what you see in those places. So I always laugh at the people, oh, I've been to Mexico, they say. And no, you haven't been to the real Mexico, and you don't know the real Mexican people any more than you know the real Iranians or Lebanese, Syrians, or people from any other country. And I also want to address the people who work for government projects. They fly to maybe Kuwait or Iraq or these other countries totally under the auspices of the American government, under government projects, under government protection. They have not seen these countries. And I just have to express how pathetic these people are in imagining that somehow they have been in those countries. So I'm not going to dwell on this, but just a slight introduction, somewhat dealing with the problem of the American big city hick. I want to add a little discussion to the idea that the United States has 4.8 billion people usage or human units of usage per day as we live our still extravagant lifestyle. And in the process, if you add up the population per human usage of Russia, Europe, the developing nations, and then add in the underdeveloped countries, third world and even fourth world countries, the extreme poverty nations of the world, we have on this planet right now a population resource usage index, I would call it, of about 15 billion people, even though the population is only about 6 billion people on planet Earth at this time. So So the problem is we are simply running out of resources. There is no way to restore the resources at the rate we're using them. We're also polluting the planet, and we are simply running out of the ability to support the planet as we see it. Now, some people have a solution. If you talk to Henry Kissinger, he'll tell you that we need to destroy about a third to two-thirds of the world population simply by eliminating them. What a great solution. Henry Kissinger, a guy who has been called a wrecking ball in terms of world domination by a certain small group of people, and I know you know who those people are. But at any rate, the problem is we simply have no leadership in terms of planning. There are, of course, the United States leadership, the Bush, Clinton, White House, and all of their business buddies on a breakneck pace of greed, attempting to get as much money as possible. And now let's go back to the topic of science. What is wrong with this picture? Because we live in possibly the most scientifically advanced culture of our time, at least. Maybe there were advanced cultures in the past with different types of advancements, different types of technology, probably spacefaring capabilities, etc. But what is wrong with the picture when this scientifically advanced nation starts to move out into the world and demand resources from the rest of the world without bound? Now, when I said 15 billion people in terms of units of resource consumption per day, I did not add in the military. The military would include, between the Russian and especially the U.S. military and the aerospace industry, all of the black ops resources, etc., the missing money, $4 trillion in the Clinton administration, an equal amount in the most recent Bush administration, the amount of resources being consumed by the military would equal another 4 to 6 billion people. So we are running a resource consumption rate on this planet at a breakneck 15 billion people-wise, another 5 billion person units of resource consumption on the military. So breaking somewhere between 20 and 22 billion people consumption units of resources on this planet every day. It simply cannot last when you couple in the pollution, and then you couple in the need of people, then you couple in the clamping down on resources such as food. The recent E. coli scare with spinach being one example, which I am firmly convinced is a plant. If you watch the movie V for Vendetta, which is required viewing for all of my listeners, I've been told that this is one of the highest selling movies ever on eBay. There are over 280 vendors now selling V for Vendetta, a movie that was not advertised highly and did not sell that big at the box office, but now people are waking up to its true message. There's somebody out there that wants you to understand some basic issues. V for Vendetta, required viewing for my audience. But back to the problem that the CIA, being an autonomous agency, unaccountable to the American public for which it was supposedly created. Remember, the CIA being formed by the Nazi SS that were brought into the United States during World War II, now in command of our scientific resources, torturing people in prisons which are scattered around the world, in Czechoslovakia, in Poland, in Syria, and supposedly Syria being one of our enemies, huge air bases being built, permanent bases being built in Iraq, in Afghanistan. Clearly, there are approximately 300,000 of our own troops from the United States missing. Where are they? What are they doing? Why do we have an alleged 90,000 Russian troops within the United States and Canada at this time? Clearly, someone has some big plans. And so, at any rate, it's a very dangerous situation as the growing number of foreign nations start to look to the United States population to remove this very tenacious problem, this problem of the United States growing down a road with a very small group of people. And as I said on my webpage, this operation cannot function without many, many people being duped, being drawn into supporting this blindly, thinking that we live in a democracy and that somehow we are bringing this democracy to the rest of the world. Be very clear that we do not live in a democracy. We have not lived in a democracy for a very long time. And the whole issue comes back to science, because it is the computer age which allows voting machines that there is no accountability for the vote that you put in, that these are rigged elections before you ever go to the ballot box, and this goes down to the very smallest town, whether it is a school bond issue, whether it is to vote for a facility for the local police station, or whether it is voting for the state governor, whether it is voting for a congressman. I get a kick out of Clinton coming and supporting the Democrats, and then Bush comes and supports fundraisers for the Republicans. Little do these people know that at the top, it doesn't make any difference who builds the roads or whatever, because at the very top, the wars, the eternal war on terror, etc., will continue no matter who you elect, because the people at the very top all work for the same company. And of course, that is what they call the CIA, is the company. Because it literally is. It's a worldwide corporation with autonomous financing, with autonomous bank accounts, 100% unaccountable to anybody or anything. So the world has a very correct and a very astute observation that the United States is a country that needs to be brought under control, and if the local population cannot do it, which I believe it cannot at this point, I do not believe that there is the ability of the American public, the will, the intestinal fortitude, or the insight to control its government. And I've talked about this before, where the United States government has to be replaced. Washington, D.C., 100% has to be removed and replaced with a constitutional, the originally intended constitutional government, with our originally intended form of value money, etc. And a lot of people in high places are starting to wake up. There's an actual division even in the high-ranking Republicans, where they're starting to wake up to the fact that this country is going down, 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 down. And so at any rate, what does this have to do with science? Well, it is the scientist, the engineer, the computer engineer who has made all of this possible, who has provided the security, the level of sophistication, underground tunnels with high levels of sophistication, biowarfare, all of the science that has gone into the and then being misused and used to guard and protect a group of insane people who are power hungry and who have gotten control. And for some reason, the population simply is unable to breach the barrier now, where the leaders are using what was originally intended to defend this country, are using it to defend and put a barrier between the public and themselves. None of this would be possible without a large volume, a large population of big city hicks in the United States, people who think they know what's going on, but have never been outside of their little playground in the United States to understand what the rest of the world really looks like. On to the next topic. Isn't this interesting? Our good friend Bill Gray, 40 years running the Hurricane Prediction Center in Colorado. Colorado State University is where this was based. And telling the world that global warming and ocean hurricanes were caused by warm water and that global warming was going to increase the situation, the occurrence and strength of hurricanes. Isn't it interesting that on, let's see, what was this? On September 19th, at a daily, at a meeting of reporters at the Larimer Country Republican Club breakfast, told the group of about 50 people, Republicans and reporters, that global warming is not due to humans. And he said, listen to this quote. This is from the newspaper. The it says, this is Professor Gray, who I very much really do not like, let's put it that way. As, for example, I watched him leave hundreds of thousands of school children in Florida schools as Hurricane Floyd marched 100 miles off the coastline. Professor Gray saying, I think we're coming out of an ice age and the warming is due to changes in ocean circulation, etc. Totally reversing his opinion on this matter. So I find it very amusing that he would basically steal my idea, which he obviously read out of my weather book, promote this to a group of Republicans because that's what President Bush wants to hear. Because it's just too expensive to talk about the cures of alleged global warming. This past week, I was a guest on a show out of Cincinnati where I'm somewhat of a regular guest with a excellent talk show host, a guy named Bill Boshiers. And Bill lets it fly. He doesn't hold back, and he knows the story. He knows what's going on behind the scenes. And so we were talking about the situation in New Orleans, Hurricane Katrina, and the blowing of the levees down there. And I have to express what happened on that show. As I was talking about the fact that I pointed out, and now listen to what I said, and I'm going to tell you what a caller said as he called in, and obviously this turning out to be a disinformation specialist from the government. And as I go on radio shows, which I've been doing for many years, decades in fact, and as I'm a guest, it's amazing how fast they direct and can get the disinformation specialists on the air to try and dissuade or disseminate my conversation, the topics that I'm talking about. What I said was that New Orleans was not destroyed by Katrina. There's a myth that that New Orleans was damaged severely by Katrina. In fact, the maximum winds in New Orleans due to Katrina were only 70 miles per hour, and Katrina only dumped about 7 inches of rain. Now, I used to live in New Orleans as I went to school at Tulane University. I rode my bicycle on the levees for all over that town. There's something like a couple hundred miles worth of levees wrapping around the city. And so I'm familiar with how they were built, the structure of these levees, and what they could withstand. I was there during flooding times, etc. So a 7-inch rain was just like an average springtime or rainy season thunderstorm in New Orleans. No big deal. So why did the levees break in 7 places at 24 hours after the storm had subsided and passed? There was no real storm surge on Lake Pontchartrain, which is to the north. And even if there were, it only would attribute to the breaking of one levee on the north side of New Orleans. So why exactly would the levees break in seven strategic places all at one time in the middle of the night, 24 hours after the storm Katrina had passed? And obviously, the storm Katrina had to do a number of missions, take out the big oil refineries up the river that fed all the way up to New York City and west, the pre-oil processing that is done as the oil is fed to the west, to the smaller refineries in Texas. So at any rate, as I went through this discussion, a call comes in because we were taking calls on that show. And by the way, this show airs through the 38 eastern states, all the way into Mexico, through the Caribbean islands, up to Nova Scotia and all of Canada east of the Rockies. So this is a widely heard show, and I'm talking about this situation with Katrina, New Orleans, and the levees. Up into the call queue comes a guy named Al. And gee, he starts out talking, and he goes, "Yeah, well, I'm just kind of an average guy. I used to live in New Orleans." And now, very subtly, obviously this guy was a pro, was placed in that queue, and it's amazing how they can get these people onto these radio shows when there's hundreds of other people calling in. Now listen to what he says and how he twists the subject. But he overdid it and really gave himself away by showing how much integral knowledge he had of the levees in New Orleans. But anyway, he tried to change my topic and talk about the weakness in the levees. And isn't it interesting that he knew the structure, the basic composition, and the entire history of pillars, cement pillars, which are totally out of sight, that were buried under those levees, some of those levees being built 50 years ago. He knew every pillar, every wave of gravel and fill that was brought into these areas in these seven locations. And that's just a little more than the average person would know. For example, I lived there in 1973 to 75, and the levees haven't changed that much since. I was there in May, just before Katrina, and I did a very quick survey of the entire city as I went around sightseeing, and the levees really hadn't changed. So here's a guy that claims he just lived there for a short while, but knew the details of the pillars, of the position of the barge that was on one of the levees. And notice how he changed the topic, because I was talking about the fact that Katrina really did not affect New Orleans. It was 24 hours later. There was only 7 inches of rain, and the big pumps, the big electric pumps, which run the water out of the lower basin of New Orleans and out into the higher waterways into the Mississippi River, etc., to drain the water off of the city, those pumps easily could handle that 7 inches of rain. It does it constantly during the summertime. 7 inches of rain in a summer thunderstorm is nothing. So why would a person divert the entire conversation to talking about the seven weak points in the levee system where these blew, or where these let go, so to speak? Now, very interesting, and this is how, in my own experience too, in dealing with the CIA and the government guys, he had an accent, and I can recognize this accent of the kind of people who work for the government. And it was not a New Orleans accent. If you live in New Orleans, you know what the New Orleans people talk like, how they speak, their mannerisms, etc. This guy maybe spent some time in New Orleans, but was not a New Orleans resident, and simply, obviously, was a front person trying to change my topic. And at the very end of his very long, involved discussion of all of the intricacies of the levees being built in these seven locations, which is by far way, way too much, he knew way too much about these seven positions in the levee for a guy who just happened to live there. Obviously, in my opinion, a person that was involved in the blowing of the levees. And he was put on that show to try and dissuade my presentation, but in doing so, exposed himself as being one of the people who was obviously involved in blowing the levees, the demolition of the levees. But at any rate, at the very end of his conversation, he said, and the levees weren't blown. They were all just naturally, you know, destroyed by Katrina. And he hung up. and we went to a commercial break. But anyway, I wanted to pass that on to my audience because, number one, it's interesting to see the how fast, when I'm on a radio show, and this happens to me regularly, it always has, how fast they can get one of their disinformation agents in there to dissuade the topics that I'm talking about. And number two, how they really identify themselves when they're in that capacity. Just a quick aside here. Last week I didn't talk about the Berkey water filter. I'm just going to quick insert some information. My recommendation is you definitely need a gravity feed water filter. The Berkey is by far the best one that I have personally found and recommended. And I'm going to give you three ways to purchase this. Once again, I believe I'm offering the best deal on the planet for the Berkey. I can't change the price of the Berkey water filter. This is the big Berkey stainless steel for $315, and that includes two extra filters. I will not sell a Berkey without the extra filters because you will need it in case of an emergency. That's all I'm going to say. Here's the 800 number, 800-983-5622. And there's a complete introductory message on that 800 number. Once again, 800-983-5622. And also on there is a deal for my four books, the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes, Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet, the Atlantis to Tesla Colburn Connection book, and the weather book. Also included the two videos which really give a good historical account of my work, the 2003 UFO Congress lecture that I gave on Planet X and the history of my science work, and then also the 2004 UFO Congress topic that I gave dealing with electric highways to the stars. And if you want to use mail order, send the $315 for the Berkey water filter. By the way, both of those include the free shortwave radio, which does very nicely pick up my show. That's Kato brand, WRX 911 shortwave radio, and that's included for free. That offer for $315 includes free shipping and the free shortwave radio. Also, the $109 offer for the books and the videos also includes the free Kato shortwave radio. Once again, that's 800, the number, telephone number, 800-983-5622. You could also send that to JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392. That's JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, and 55392, or visit my website, which the abbreviated form to get you there quickly, www.jmccsci.com. That's J as in jmccsci.com, www.jmccsci.com. That's all I'm going to say about that. Up to a Popocatepetl update. Once again, now I've talked about this before, the Popocatepetl being a large volcano outside of Mexico City, and it is once again on a four-day cycle, and once again, large steam eruptions on August 26th, September 1st, September 11th, September 15th, and September 19th, a fairly significant steam outventing on that volcano. Once again, huffing and puffing, it's impossible to say when, if or when this volcano might go, but I do keep an eye on that because it is so pivotal in the central Cordillera mountain chain going south to Antarctica, going all the way north to Alaska through the San Andreas Fault of California and up to the Kamchatka Peninsula of Russia, and which is one of the most active volcanic regions in the world, and down to Japan and into the Sumatra area. So Popo being a pivotal volcano in the Western Hemisphere. Just a quick note on space junk. Of course, NASA making this bizarre announcement that on the morning of the, which day? Tuesday morning, this came out about 2:45 a.m. Eastern Time. And, of course, I was getting calls immediately by people who always call me up for their opinion. And I did do some radio shows giving expert opinion on this issue. And we played a little game of cat and mouse with NASA as this announcement came out. And I'll tell you exactly why this announcement was very strange. First of all, I'll tell you what happened with the announcement. As I said, 2:45 a.m. Eastern Time, NASA gave an announcement that one of the astronauts, while doing checkout work, getting ready for the Wednesday reentry of Space Shuttle Atlantis, spotted an object underneath the shuttle, between Earth and the shuttle, tracing the path of the shuttle. In other words, it was in the same path. And so then there were updates throughout the day, which came at about 3 to 4 hour intervals. And as the day wore on, and as we got into midday on Tuesday, it became very clear that something was amiss. Now, first of all, NASA typically, if they had an unidentified flying object, which obviously this was by definition, it was an object unidentified, and it was flying in unison with the shuttle. Now, let me tell you exactly what would happen, and what I'm sure did happen as soon as this was discovered. First of all, within probably less than a minute, the clearinghouse for space junk greater than 4 inches, which obviously this was, would be cleared by the government clearinghouse, and there are nearly 100,000 pieces of space junk up there. The general tracking house keeps track of the larger objects greater than 4 inches, that is their orbits, their velocities, etc., and where they came from, the spacecraft or rocket or whatever space probe that these objects came from is known and tracked. Then it would go through that database, and then there would be a second database of military, which is classified, of course. But all of this would take place within about a minute. So for NASA to come out and say 12 hours later that it simply doesn't know what this object is totally a lie. And so in catching NASA in one of its lies, herein is the catch, the clinch of the situation. Now, also within minutes of this, the military telescope optical tracking system that is in place around the globe would immediately look into this object, scope it out from Earth-based land stations, and by the way, they can see a grapefruit on the moon. They could see the bumps on the grapefruit on the moon. That's how good the military optics are. Much of it located on Haleakala, the Maui volcano, and that's also where they keep the supercomputers for tracking orbital data calculation. This is the biggest supercomputer bank in the world, run by the U.S. Black Ops military operation. So clearly they could have seen and observed this object and known exactly what it was, but almost 12 hours later, NASA is still claiming ignorance as to what the object is. And so I put a posting on my page, and I was playing a little game of cat and mouse with NASA, because my guess was at that point that they wanted someone, probably like myself, to come out and say that this was a UFO. And that's what I did, because there was a very good reason for posting that. Number one, the orbit was concurrent, or in the same exact orbit as the space shuttle itself. Now, the space shuttle is in a very unusual orbit, and very difficult for Earth-based launches to duplicate. So for something to be exactly under the shuttle and tracking with it hour after hour, orbit after orbit, this had to be very exactly placed. And secondly, if something is in orbit that's closer to the Earth, it's going to move faster. If it's a natural object, something without propulsion, it's going to be moving faster at a higher angular velocity than the space shuttle itself. So in a matter of less than an hour, certainly, and certainly less than 12 or 14 hours, this object would move away very rapidly. So it implied that this object was under control or propulsion, and that, in fact, it was under some form of intelligent control. So I put that posting on my webpage, waiting for NASA in a cat and mouse game to see what would transpire. And as the time went on, I just couldn't believe my ears and eyes as I saw the postings where one of the astronauts said, "Well, it looks like one of those things you hang a picture with or a bag of garbage." Then they showed a picture that looked something like the Pillsbury Doughboy or the Michelin Little Tire Man. And clearly, then they said, "Oh, there's a couple of them." Now, remember that when the shuttle first goes up and opens up the bay doors, many times there are things that come loose and float out, and it's either wrappings of a satellite or something else, and they just let it go. But they had been up, docked to the space station, and then left. So for something to be exactly in the same orbit as the shuttle, many hours after leaving the space station, was extremely unusual. So you could not account for this based on anything that happened early in the launch, early in the docking with the space station, or their leaving the space station many hours earlier. Because now you understand that the shuttle has an orbit of a couple hours or less. And so it's going around the Earth every couple hours. So 12, 14 hours later pass, orbit after orbit pass, this object is still between the shuttle and Earth. So obviously something hokey is going on here. So then I wait 3 hours and I make my second posting, which says basically that something is amiss here. The radio show that I gave information to put out the same information, that NASA is somehow pulling the chain of the public. And I projected at that time, although I made many possible scenarios in my head and talked to many people trying to get a scenario as to why would NASA put out this total misinformation, what I thought was that the New World Order, their fourth stage of fear tactic, is to put out a bogus alien invasion. And I thought, with, of course, NASA being controlled, could this be the initial phase of some kind of bogus plant information that NASA wanted to put out there? And then the later stories started claiming that they thought this was space junk. Well, obviously it's not space junk, because NASA, the military for sure, has full capability of understanding what is out there in terms of space junk. And they also, if they didn't know what it was, they have full capability of observing it within minutes with their optical network from around the world, processing the data, knowing where this came from, where the launch occurred that would have placed it in that orbit, etc. So obviously, we still don't know the full story. Obviously, disinformation involved, and obviously, something very strange going on for an object to be able to stay under the space shuttle orbit after orbit for 12 to 14 hours, even longer, and not be identified. And then, comically enough, the NASA, and this is what I always love about NASA, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing, so they announce that the military scopes are examining the underside of the shuttle for defects. And obviously that's what did not happen in 2003 when the space shuttle came down and burnt up over Texas at the last major space disaster of NASA, when the military refused to look at the space shuttle because they were afraid somebody would find out what kind of observation capabilities they had. Well, NASA announced this time that, in fact, the optical network was looking and examining the space shuttle. But it never said anything about the network looking at these unidentified objects and trying to figure out what they were. Well, obviously this was going on, so I just wanted to inform the public, as we watched this story develop, the incredible amount of misinformation coming out of NASA, and why they released this story is very uncharacteristic of NASA, as they would have typically waited until they knew what it was before announcing this. On to the science topic of the night. I want to talk about the rings of Saturn, and just a new announcement that came out. There is a new ring that's been discovered around Saturn, spotted by the Cassini mission, and this being announced just yesterday. Coming out, this was a Reuters posting, and of course this came out in many different news services. The new ring is an unexpected structure in the E-ring, and now when I wrote my papers on Saturn's rings, actually the papers were in 1980 when I was at Cornell University, and I talked about the title of the paper was Saturn's Sweeper Moons Predicted. And now they are actually finding these moons. They're finding the interactions of these moons with the ring system, and of course giving credit to NASA scientists for these discoveries, and somehow the understanding that these moons are in fact influencing the rings and guiding them and shaping them. But remember that in 1980, when I was at Cornell, the belief was that, at that time, was that the ring system was generated during the origin of the solar system, and that they had been floating up there ever since. And of course, nothing could be farther than the truth. Now we see clearly in the Cassini data, and it was also available in the Voyager data, as I was at Cornell, and that when that data was coming in, that the rings are shaped and developed by the moons, and you can see the moon material coming into the ring material coming in and being drawn into the moons. They've actually observed this now, so that in effect is the same situation as the plasma discharge comet model, where the nucleus draws in the material in the vicinity by strong electrical forces. The electrical forces combining to create the cometary shape, Saturn being a small star, and of course, all of this being ignored, NASA still trying to talk about the gravitational field of these moons. Now, we're talking about objects that are maybe a mile across or less in outer space, and they're talking about the gravitational field. There's not enough gravitational field on an object that size to maintain or hold a piece of dust, let alone draw material in from the far reaches hundreds of miles away, etc. And so I want to read a couple statements that came out in these articles. For example, Dr. Caldwell, of course, from my old school, Cornell, said, "The very sharp transitions at the ring edges were not expected." And I find that rather comical, because that paper that I published in the Astrophysics Journal, 1980, called Saturn Sweeper Moons Predicted, said exactly that, that the edges, the inside edges of the ring should be sharply defined, with the outside ring, the outside ring edges should be sharply defined, with the inside ring edges fading gradually. And that's exactly what they're seeing here, and that's due to the cometary sweeping of the moons, and thus the name of the paper, Saturn's Sweeper Moons Predicted. This paper was published in the space science journal Moon and the Planets. One of the papers that I published in astrophysics journals before getting blackballed and somewhat removed from the ability to publish. But anyway, in light of this, I want to talk about Saturn's rings in terms of the electrical nature of Saturn being a small star. Now, many of you are familiar with my electrical, the plasma discharge comet model, which shows that in a capacitor created by the Sun, the object, which is not an ice ball, it's just an object, it could have ice on it, does not have to have ice on it, it's just some object, in the electrical field of the Sun, discharges that capacitor created by the Sun, and the comet shape is the result, with the positively charged ions from the outside coming in, and that's the tail that you see. And then there's an invisible electron beam that comes out from the sunward side, and the situation at Saturn and Jupiter, by the way, is exactly the same, because these are small star-like objects that produce a fusion wind, this fusion wind being detected by Voyager, the Voyager spacecraft, as early as 1980 at Jupiter and then also at Saturn. So these are small stars, and by the way, that's also a reason why I would not classify Jupiter or Saturn as planets. I would classify them as small stars. I would reclassify Pluto as a planet, and its moon, so-called moon Charon, as I would classify that as a twin planet, just like Earth and our own moon would classify as a twin planet. I would classify Titan, the big moon of Saturn, I would classify that as a planet. It has an atmosphere, and it orbits a star. That star we call Saturn. So at any rate, back to the rings. Now, it occurred to me very early in my research that the rings of Saturn had to be due to an ongoing process. In other words, because of the dynamic nature of the moon particles and the fact that they were sweeping this material out, that meant that the rings themselves had to be continually generated from a source, and that the source was ongoing, and that the rings were a dynamic process, and so they were not there from the origin of the solar system, which supposedly is billions of years ago. So here's how the process works. I'll describe the entire process of the rings of Saturn. Now, Saturn, being a small star, is expelling a proton wind, and protons are the basic atomic structure of the atom hydrogen, or the molecular form hydrogen, we call hydrogen gas H2, which is a basic component of water. So, once again, they have just discovered that there is a tremendous amount of oxygen around Saturn. These are the basic components of water. Also, the same fundamental makeup of the main component in comet tails. So, at any rate, you have the components there to build up water. And so it's the very clear that there is dust involved, materials that would be small microscopic particles. But the main component of the ring system itself is water and water ice. Excuse me, just as the main component of a comet tail would be just the same. So here's how it works. I'll give you a brief summary. Saturn is expelling the protons, the basis for hydrogen, expelling it. There's a large hydrogen cloud surrounding Saturn. We know that from the Voyager spacecraft. We know from the Cassini spacecraft that there's a large volume of molecular oxygen. You have all of the components of water. Now, what happens is these have to somehow funnel back into Saturn. And if Saturn has this proton wind coming off, the water cannot come in from all directions and fall back into Saturn. So it has to come back in the equatorial plane of Saturn, which is very interesting. So the only path that this material, once the water forms, is to come back in the plane of the ecliptic or the rotational plane of Saturn, and that's why all of the water starts to orbit around Saturn, and this is somewhat of a complex orbital problem. I don't have time to describe all of this on this show, but as it forms water and then begins to orbit in, then it starts to form the ring structures. But in the gaps in the rings are small moonlets. These moonlets simply sweep out the area where their orbits lie, and they are constantly circling in. So the orbits of the structure of the rings is constantly changing. So I suspect that a few hundred years ago, the rings of Saturn looked a bit different than they do today. And in a few hundred years, the structure of the rings and the gaps in the rings will look different than they do today. So the ring system is changing. It's not a permanent structure, as was suggested 25 years ago. But so there's a dynamic process. Now, the moonlets, the small moon particles that are in the rings, act as comets. They are drawing in material from the rings, and as a result, the outside ring edges are very well defined, just like the nose side of the comet, the sunward side of the comet, is much shorter than the tail side. So it's exactly the comet shape, the electrical nature of comets, that forms the Saturn rings as we see them today. It's certainly not due to gravity, and that's one of the problems I had to work with as I defined my early paper on the sweeper moons of Saturn, because gravitational fields are very weak. And I made some calculations, and I showed that if the ring fading effect, the ring edging effect, were due to gravity, that the small particles would have to be as dense as the material in a neutron star. And that seemed rather unlikely. The more likely explanation was that the ring edge fading was due to electrical effects. Also, there were many other electrical effects that were coming back in the data from the Voyager spacecraft, so that led me to the firm conviction that, in fact, the situation with Saturn was purely electrical. And so I find it amazing. We are in 2006. And NASA scientists are still trying to attempt to somewhat borrow my material but still attribute it to gravity and ignore the very source of the ring edge fading, the control of the rings of Saturn, and that it is truly due to the electrical nature, the star-like nature of Saturn as being a small star. Once again, I'm out of time. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.